If you see something, say something. At Reply, weird things come with any weird story you find on the web, and you can help make weirdthings.com even weirder.
Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
It started as a game. At Ellison High School, the student body's favorite sport is waging medieval warfare with their rivals over a hidden fortune. To win, they have to battle for control of the forest and obey a code of conduct to keep their war from spilling into the outside world. The woods between the schools are filled with dangers and dark secrets. Central among them is Ven Maddox, the youngest student to ever lead a clan into the game. Brilliant and manipulative, some think he's a sociopath who may have killed to protect his own secrets. New kid Marv Whitlock, already dealing with his own troubles, finds himself in the middle of a decade-old conflict and has to use his wits to avoid being one more pawn. Best-selling author Andrew Main brings you Night School, an adventurous cross of Friday Night Lights and Game of Thrones. Available now for only 99 cents on the Amazon Kindle Store, Barnes & Noble Nook Store, or Apple's iTunes. Stay tuned to the end of this podcast, and you'll hear the first two chapters read by Justin Robert Young.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Weird Things Podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined right now, straight out of Sim City, Mr. Brian Brushwood.
Oh my God, it's kicked out of Sim City. It was like they logged in and everything froze. It was a DRM nightmare up in this BZH.
Yeah, it's a bit of a kerfuffle.
Who's that? That other voice you hear, slightly more mature, slightly more grown up, because it's his birthday, Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Yes, it's me. Hi. Did you get any pal, Justin Robert Young?
Did you get a gift?
My name day.
Did you get anything for your name day? What loot did you get?
I think I've crossed the Rubicon of like getting things. Like I've gotten into the, like, it's just, the diminishing returns of what I expect and what I'm given for my birthday. Like, it's just, I'm on the slow march to, like, it'd be nice to get a call.
So, speaking of which, how excited are you?
Watch your mailbox. You got not one, but two presents coming, my friend.
How excited are you?
I've gotten a bunch of, Ashley got me a bunch of fun stuff, and I got a bunch of awesome things.
How excited are you for 60 more years? Like, now at age 30, you could look forward to more and more people for the rest of your life calling you Justin Robert, just a little less young.
Oh.
Yeah, you know, I think that's, it's the price you pay for an adjective last name, you know? It's awesome, people remember it, but, you know, you live and die. You live and die by the adjective.
That's true.
So let's start off with a little bit of birthday make-believe.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, as we get older, we don't have the same expectations like when we're kids. You know, we're a kid, we walk through a toy store, and every square foot is filled with the delight and the latest thing we want. As you get older, you're kind of like, maybe I just want some gift certificates. And now, like, those pile up in my wallet. Now I'm kind of like, maybe my Amazon gift card. Like, don't get me anything, you know. I'm close to that point right now.
Yeah.
But I want you to imagine Justin.
For my birthday, just leave me alone. Just stop looking at me. Stop muttering that under your breath. That's all I want.
All right, go ahead.
Imagine there's a box in front of you, Justin. Box. Maybe about 15 inches by 15 inches by 15 inches.
Okay.
This is your birthday box. You open this birthday box.
Yes.
What is it besides a better camera mount?
No, I'm trying to get it so it's like it's eye line. Keep it low and then just turn the thing.
This is great for the audio.
What is
listeners.
In the box? The box has
Ashley's head. That is a horrible thing to say.
No, it's not Ashley's head. It's
what's in the box?
No, she's just doing her laughs. No, it's I would say untold wealth.
Well, so you mean like the Hope Diamond or something in there?
No, no, no. A credit card that just never runs out.
Oh, all right. In order to support that, you'd have to have an infrastructure that's far larger than the box.
Well, I mean, listen, I was just asked about what's in the box.
Why don't you just say, all right.
Gwyneth Paltrow's head.
I mean, you can open it and be like, and it's the credit card. Warren Buffett, in this sort of really dodgy written letter that you realize he's got Alzheimer's and gave you this credit card but forgot about it.
He's like, please spend this in remembrance of me. I'm Warren Buffett.
Yeah. Pick me up a few things, whatever. You know, here's to get my pills and the New York Times. No, actual New York Times.
Yes, please buy it. And you should be able to negotiate it down to like a $700 tag and they'll throw in the offices.
All right. Bri, what's yours?
Ah, dude, if we're talking like some kind of serious wealth, can it be an object that's not necessarily invented yet? Can I wish
sure.
to stone?
Sure, sure. I like the idea that it's contained in the box. So instead of Justin's credit card, we're going to get him like a pile of cash.
All right. Well, then for me, you know, some kind of science fiction. I would tough call. I don't know if you could fit both a portal gun and a lightsaber in there. But if you could, I'd want both. We'll say a portal gun, a lightsaber, a functional phaser, stun gun, and what was that thing that the Tomorrow People used? The joint? I want to say jaunt? Where they
get joints. They smoke joints.
They could jaunt without having to have a device. But if you were if you weren't a Tomorrow person, you had to have like the little helper thing. Right,
give me one of those two, and also from the multiple Earths things. Was it Larry Niven, David Niven? It was the conceit of the book was that there were all these Earths that were in parallel next to each other, and you could jump westward or eastward using a simple box. But the box was just kind of like a MacGuffin. To tell yourself, you know, that you needed the box to believe you could jump from one to the other. One of those two.
Like marijuana.
Yes.
So
also like just on like some black tar heroin, just so I could sell it and make a little cash.
So you just want to seem cool amongst your friends.
I think maybe like the Iron Man suit.
Oh, like that one that was in the briefcase from Iron Man 2.
Like an extremist nano armor or something like that. That's all. That's all I'm asking for. Nothing comes. Because you could fly and beat up your enemies.
Man, I used to love Iron Man so much that I would read and reread. Marvel Universe used to have this comic book that was nothing but like a mugshot drawing of each character full body. From side angles and everything, and just a list of all their awesome numbers. And I remember seeing like Iron Man armor specifically multiplied your strength times 90. And I would do the math. I would be like, all right, I could lift like 50 pounds. So I'd be like 500 pounds. So 4,500 pounds. Wow. I'd be strong. And
meanwhile, Brian, are you doing your math homework? No.
Yeah. I'm trying to fantasize, Mom.
Yeah, I love that stuff. I like whenever you would find like the specs on, let's say, the Batcave or what. Because I'm looking at that, like that was my Architectural Digest as a kid. Like, this is what I'm going to do when I grow up.
Yeah, absolutely.
These are the plans. This is what I'd like to go with. So, I think that's interesting. I think we revealed quite a bit about ourselves here.
Yes,
Justin, the capitalistic money grubbing. Sociopath.
Well, because, you know, you always just want, I mean, this is like the genie question. Like, you just always want the wish that gets you more wishes. You know, like, that's the ultimate
goal. So what you're saying is money is wishes is right. in paper let form.
Money is the ever-replicating source of money is that.
So
all right, let me narrow the question down for it. Let's bring it into the realm of possibility. You get a phone call right now. Okay, yep. Literally, the all phone right. rings. Like, but it's from Redmond, Washington.
Okay.
Who?
Hi, it's Bill Gates.
Okay.
And, I'm a big fan. Big fan.
Bill, really? Wow.
I can send you
it's an honor.
Anything in this 15 by 15 by 15 inch box, the scenario that Andrew just described. What's it going to be?
So I can't get like the credit card that just never really runs out. Like, well, I'll just be tapping on
like,
the
no fantasy like, things. It's just got to be a simple thing that he could put in there. See, here's the thing: like, you want to wish for some kind of precious resource, but then the problem is now you're gambling on like which resource will remain precious. Because, like, diamonds are valuable right now, but for all we know, the De Beers oligarchy will just all of a sudden, or oligopoly, will all of a sudden just, you know, what's, because, you know, they could grow diamonds now. They make that, I don't know what they use to seed it, but they make that gaseous mixture of, like, methane and a bunch of carbon. I'm getting it all wrong.
All right. Hey, Brian.
What?
Shut up. I'm on the phone with Bill Gates.
Okay.
Well, Bill.
What's up?
I want the patents to Microsoft Office.
Well, he that Microsoft owns that, so.
Yeah.
It's like, it's going to be something physical inside of the box.
I think my favorite part of what just happened is how, like, I got quiet waiting patiently, like, what's he say? Did he give it? Yeah. Like, something about Justin actually holding a phone up to his head has me convinced that this is real.
And now there's the caveat. Bill thinks it's stupid. He's going to hang up.
Uh-oh.
Oh, all right. Man.
This is
I'll
like,
tell you what.
This is like the Price is Right without going over rule that changes things.
Yeah, because you don't want to do something stupid like, I don't know, a steak. You don't want that. You want something cool, something unique, something amazing that, like, you could get from nobody else in the world but Bill Gates.
Like, could it be like a special, like, very, very biologically rare egg of some variety? That'd be kind of cool. Like a Yeti egg. Yetis hatch from eggs, right?
The dragon eggs?
Dragon eggs?
I think Bill's regretting the phone call right now.
Okay.
I think it's fair to say that if Bill Gates is a fan of either this podcast or any other podcast I'm on, this is easily, like, we're batting in the middle of how dumb I can get.
Oh, yeah. I let's assume for the moment that Bill does not believe that Yeti eggs are real.
All right.
Let's use that as a baseline. That he might think a Yeti egg maybe is like, is that something I can get in, like, the Hamler Schlimmler catalog or whatever?
The Hamaker Schlimmer. Man, okay, look, I'm just gonna go for it. I'll say I want an equal mix of diamonds, gold nuggets, platinum, and how valuable are rare earth magnets yet? Not, or isn't there going to be a shortage of that? And antimatter. There you go. I want some antimatter in there too.
All right.
In fact, the whole thing antimatter. I'll figure out a use for it.
Yeah, isn't it like nickel mines? Like, that's what, like there's like Russian, like the guy who owns like the Brooklyn Nets is like, you know, a nickel mine owner. And apparently the way you own a nickel mine in Russia is by walking into a nickel mine with a gun and saying, I own the nickel mine.
Really? All right.
Apparently it's a bit of a wild west out there in Russia.
So what would you get in there, Andrew?
You know, I think you think, like, what has the most value? You know, Brian mentioned, like, precious jewels and rubies and things like that. I wonder though, like, what are the most valuable objects by weight? And I wonder if it might even be like processors.
Oh, sure.
Oh.
You know, I wonder if you had, you know, whatever the highest end processors are. Because, you know, the processor is actually just a little thin wafer inside that little plastic case. And I wonder if you just said, well, Bill, you know a thing or two about electronics.
You know, what it reminds me of is when I was, and this is a few engineers out there will remember this time. And you might remember it, Andrew. But, like, in the early 90s. There was, I remember, and this is pre-internet. Like, maybe the internet was there, but nobody was using it. Maybe because it was on BBS or whatever. Yeah, certainly no World Wide Web. And I remember going and buying, I think it was RAM at some shop. And they said, hey, you might want to buy as much RAM as you can because there was a fire at a plant and RAM's about to go up in price. I'm like, first of all, that's dumb. Everyone knows computers. Everything gets cheaper over time. Yeah. What I didn't understand at the time and what took years for me to grasp was that a fire meant that there are three major RAM manufacturers in the whole world. And, like, one of them exploded, basically. And then the next year, like, the RAM doubled, tripled, quadrupled in price. And it was so weird. Like that almost would never happen now. Like, that moment of
Hard drives.
That moment of a guy saying, hey, this is very cheap right now, but when the wave of information hits, this is going to be crazy expensive, so you might want to buy more. That wave, that shock wave of information happens instantaneously.
Worldwide. Yeah. Like by the time you hear about it, it's already more expensive.
Yeah.
You know, it's curious is that's when you have to look for like those signals that are further away from what could be happening. And, you know, is
you have to think about like secondary and tertiary effects of things happening.
Yeah. And like, you know, like is, you know, oh, you know, did such and such RAM company, are they taking, you know, more orders than they'll be able to have? Are they going to have bankruptcy payment issues or something? Are they, yeah. I mean, it's weird. The entire, you know, fund managers, all they do is try to study that, predict what will happen from those things, which, you know, the origins of that was agriculture. And, you know, are we going to have a good season or not? If we think it's going to be a bad season, then we're going to buy up as much grain as we can and overcharge those Hittites. Do we have a commercial?
No. You know what? Can I give one away? I'd like to give away a plug to someone. A friend of the show, if you ever watch a little thing called A Totally Rad Show, then you know that Jeff Cannata, along with Dan Trachtenberg and Alex Albrecht, hosted a show all about sci-fi geek things, whether it's board games, comic books, movies, books, television. And I suspect that any one of those three gentlemen would be completely awesome to have on this show sometime. But specifically, you know, Dan Trachtenberg is out there directing Why the Last Man now, and Alex Albrecht has other big projects he's doing. Jeff Cannata wants very much to carry the torch for the Totally Rad Show, and he just launched a new Kickstarter for his next project. And of course, it won't be the Totally Rad Show, but it will fill that niche in a new way. He's got ideas that I really like. He launched it, I believe, 2 hours ago. And as I look at it right now, it looks to be almost 80% funded in just 2 hours. That's how much goodwill. And to be honest, this guy, I think he under-asked for it under his goal. Do me a favor. Head on over to Kickstarter.com. Just type in Jeff Cannata and throw him some bucks. Because
how do you spell Cannata, Bri?
Two N's, one T. Cannata.
There we go. No, he was on NSFW this week. He's an awesome guy. His project's going to be great. You know, he described it to me, for anybody who gets, you know, this reference, that he wants to do kind of a pardon the interruption style show for geeks, which I think is something that, you know, has long since been an idea that could have its due. So,
well, and we even tossed around that idea with Game On for a little bit, but it never quite, you know, or that style of thing. We wanted to model a lot of Game On sports. Sports Center shows, but that never quite happened. So it'd be great to see that happen with Jeff's project.
Absolutely. Check it out.
Very, very cool. I have a question for you, Brian.
Yeah.
And there's a connection here. A while ago, a friend of yours, a rather eccentric friend, which says a lot, given your friends.
So, yeah, it actually sounds a little bit redundant when you say my eccentric friend. So one of my friends, yes.
Had an opportunity, very incredible opportunity, but for reasons he could better explain, gave up that opportunity to take it up later on, and that opportunity fell upon somebody else, and they became the world first private citizen to become an astronaut.
I knew. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
You're
so
talking about
that was Richard Garriott was going to be the first guy up going space privately. And then he sold his ticket to Dennis Tito, and Dennis Tito got to be the first guy up there. And this is a little funny side note. So, you know, NASA will not let you call your NASA says will not acknowledge that anybody who goes up is an astronaut. Right.
Right.
You're like,
yeah.
You know, like, oh, no, you're not. You have some.
But strangely, they will call an astronaut to someone who's never left the planet.
Yes. And it's going to be very interesting because SpaceX is supposed to be testing eventually their rocket with their own SpaceX crew and sending them up into space. And are we going to still hold that? No, sorry. You guys are not astronauts mentality, which is silly, but that's not the point I was going to bring up. It'll just be curious to see where NASA, you know, and that, there was NASA, and I would say in the last few years, is different than what NASA was before. When Tito went up and out, there was this weird kind of hostility towards private space exploration. It was this, oh, we, you know, this guy's buying his way up there. That's wrong. Meanwhile, we'll put a senator up there.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
To test, you know, how space is going to affect old people.
Yeah, well, exactly. Well, it's important we set you up so that we could just, like, look at how old you are.
Yeah.
John Glenn, yeah. We need you up there. We're really curious. There's all this medicine to be discovered in zero G, but we want to know, like, seriously, how old are you? And we'd like to see how you look all floating with your old, wrinkly skin.
And that was a different administration. A lot of things have changed. NASA is you know, you can't. You know, they've got a much more, I think the attitude is in a much positive place now. Now, Dennis Tito came out, press conference, said, hey, you know what would be really cool? Let's send some people in a spaceship to go do a flyby of Mars. Not land on Mars.
Yeah.
But not do an orbit, because that would take extra fuel, but to do a flyby. So basically, there are these opportunities when the Earth's orbit and Mars' orbit comes in alignment. You can send something away from Earth, pretty high velocity. It hits the Mars gravity well, loops around Mars, and comes back to Earth in a gravity slingshot.
So, like, okay. I guess if we want to picture it in the fastest, easiest configuration – it would be like, let's say you got the orbit of Earth. When you're the farthest west of the sun, we'll say that's A. The farthest east is B. You jump off. This is what I'm picturing. Tell me if I'm right. And let's say.
I'm so confused already, but please continue.
Well, picture a clock then. Fine. Sun's in the middle, right? And so the Earth is at 9 o'clock. We'll say that Mars is in a farther out orbit at 12. And so you jump off at 9 o'clock, you swing towards Mars, you whip around and whip past it, and then you land on Earth at the 3 o'clock spot. Did any of that make sense?
I'm sure it did.
All right. I'm not hitting the same.
I know
rhythm.
That we're going to rock around the clock tonight.
On Mars.
Yes, with Haley and his comments. So how long of a trip is this? Like, what are we talking about time-wise?
So it's the trip is based upon the idea that there's you get these optimum points in which, you know, Mars is coming close to or, you know, within a period of time when it's the optimum point. And we have, like, I think one in the 2 years, then once in 2018, the next one's not going to be for like till 2030. OK,
yeah.
So the trip, if they launch in 2018, again, it's 5 years away, would take 501 days.
That does not sound untenable. I mean, this is how long did it take to get to the New World? Or if you're Magellan was gone for what, 2 years? 2.5 years? I'm going to look this up. Here, you keep talking. I'm going to find out how long Magellan was out.
Yeah, but Magellan was still comfortably within the Earth's atmosphere, not bombarded by cosmic rays.
Yeah, but he had sharks.
That he could eat.
Yeah.
Okay, there's that too.
Mermaids,
The longest duration is still like 464 days.
Wait a minute. Hold on. Here he goes. 1519 to 1522. 3 years. That's twice. So this is twice as long as this trip.
But it wasn't 3 years all at sea.
No, that's true. What? But also, he didn't have penicillin and science.
Yes. So and the number of people who returned on that voyage was what percentage of the people that left?
I don't know, not much. But what I'm saying is that, you know, we got a long history of explorers, and
I don't think it's a matter of necessarily the willpower as much as the technology. So
yeah, can we do this physically?
So the tentative plan is if the Falcon Heavy, which SpaceX is working on and hopes to be able to test sometime this year. To use one Falcon Heavy to send your spaceship off, accelerate, you know, launch this thing out of Earth's atmosphere, out of Earth orbit, towards Mars, do the slingshot, come back at a ridiculously high rate of speed. And that's one of the things is you have what's called, Mars entry, lunar entry velocities, which is how fast you have to come back to sort of, you know, escape, you know, their orbits, whatever. Anyhow. We have the shielding now, Pika X, which is a very, very high intensity shielding that can handle this, and that's what the Dragon craft has, and that's what it was developed. Pika was developed by NASA. Then the Pika X is a newer, cheaper version that's better, whatever. Anyhow, it's one of those we can lay out on paper and say, okay, we have all these little pieces of technology here. The bigger challenge comes into assuming we have a Falcon Heavy. If we don't, we could use a couple other conventional rockets to assemble this thing. 500 days in space is a long time, and it's a long time because you're going to be in something that's going to have maybe 500 or 600 cubic feet. I don't know. Maybe it'll be a little bit larger, but you're going to be a very, very small area. Everything you eat and drink has to be contained inside of there. We've never gone 500 days without a resupply of the space station. You've got the other problem is the radiation. Intense cosmic rays. Okay. And
okay, now what do you say? Like some people are like, you just put shielding on there. Like, what? Why can't you just have shielding?
And also, how do you respond to the scientific paper that was put out where Reed Richards and Sue Storm and their brother and his friend went up there and came back with superpowers?
Yeah, come on. You're telling me the cosmic rays are all bad? Then explain.
Not all bad. It probably helped some of the mutations that brought life about on Earth. But here's the thing. So there is a plan for handling this and to minimize the effect of cosmic rays, but they're looking for a man and wife, ideally, past the childbearing age, because the chances of having healthy children after this are going to be greatly diminished, and also maybe to reduce the idea of, you know, a pregnancy midway. But anyhow, that's the radiation will be intense, but it's survival. We had, you know, astronauts 464 days up there. They're going to try to shield. Radiation shielding is an evolving technology, and it's getting progressively better. And we have things like that eventually we're going to go from sort of reactive shielding to where we'll probably be able to do that, you know, mission safely. But radiation is a serious.
Now, when you talk about reactive shielding, like what one of the things that that protects us here on Earth is the magnetic field, right? We have this incredible big magnetic shield. Like, could we not? Are there any plans that you know of to replicate a similar effect? Essentially, make a force field shield, basically.
You have a magnetosphere, and you also have a very thick atmosphere.
Okay.
Okay. There are plans to do things like one idea is to try to use magnetic fields. Another thing is to actually use basically like layers of like a metal sort of mesh or netting. When a particle hits it, it basically creates a counter particle, whatever, annihilates it, or basically it reroutes and recharges. And so reactive shielding is the idea of every time it gets hit, it basically tries to redirect or whatever. Mm-hmm. Math, I don't understand. But there are plans here, but that won't be ready by then. They have a plan, though. They do have a plan, though, because the biggest problem is other than, you know, you can fit enough food and water inside of it, but they have a plan to help prevent to diminish some of the effects of cosmic rays. But I want to ask you right now, I mean, does this sound like an interesting, you know, 500 days?
Yeah.
Would you go, Brian?
Dude, well, how many folks are we talking? Is it the three of us?
Just two people.
Can I pick the other person?
Yeah, I mean, they're looking for husband and wife, so if you and Bonnie want to go.
All right. Oh, it'd be a good getaway.
So 5 years, that means what?
500
Penny
days.
Is 14?
500 days.
500
so, days. No, but it's 5 years from now.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
This happens.
Yes.
It's 2018.
Yeah. Penny is turning 14. Holy crap. Uh-huh. And I guess Callie's now a five-year-old running around. We're like, all right, we'll see you in a couple of years. Mommy and Daddy have to go to Mars just to look at it. Now, here's the bad part. Like, you get all that way. And all you do is get yourself a close gander. That's all you get out of it.
Yeah.
That's kind of.
I mean, but you are, you know, how many times in life do you get the opportunity to literally be the trailblazers that have gone the furthest of any adventurer ever?
Okay.
You will have the most impressive adventure in the history of humanity.
I guess.
And cancer.
Well, yes. I mean,
possibly cancer.
Yeah.
Listen, higher risk of cancer. We're rolling the dice on cancer here, folks. But you want to know what? I'm privy to these secret plans. I know what our shielding solution's going to be.
Is it what I think it is? Because I think I read an article about this.
Brian?
Yeah?
We want you and Bonnie. What? First, are you in? Are you signing
up? Of course. No, done. Yeah. We'll take a trip. We'll be pioneers.
The good news is we have the technology already. In fact, it resides in your home.
Whoa, fantastic. You mean to shield everything? I'll be okay?
Absolutely. And it will be completely self-contained. The shielding will have a complete correlation to the weight of your food.
Oh, fantastic. Wait, what?
No, we're not,
what a weird thing for you to say.
We're not going to have to carry anything else extra.
Nope. Wait, so you're saying, like, we'll leave and we don't.
Yeah.
Well, because I'm in the ship right now and I'm looking around. I see a ton of food. See a ton of food everywhere. They got to, like, this place is wallpapered with like, ready to eat food packets, but I don't see any shielding.
Well, Brian, the shielding lies in you.
What, you inject something in me? Oh, I get it. It's like a vaccine against cosmic rays. Easy.
No.
Got it. What?
It resided in you before you even took this mission.
What?
In fact, you've been creating this shielding for as long as you've lived.
Is the shielding boogers?
Andrew, what is the shielding?
Butt boogers. So the part of the plan of providing shielding.
Hold on. I can't let that go. I have never heard the phrase butt boogers before in my life, but it is instantly my all-time favorite phrase.
As I was going to say, Andrew has officially invented Penny's favorite word.
I can't wait to use that on Penny. All right, go ahead.
So the idea is to use, you're inside the sealed thing, and when you use the bathroom in space, it's not like they open up a chamber that opens up to the outside and everything gets, you know, ejected.
Shot out, sure.
Like the whole of, like, you know, some bus that a rock and roll band uses to travel across America. No.
Right.
What happens there is that this is all contained inside of there, and it's a contained system. And so the idea is you're going to use the bathroom, and it's going to go inside of, they call these stealable pouches that are then going to be affixed to the walls.
So you're saying, like, you'll literally be dropping bricks that will make up your protective fort.
Yeah. So that's your...
I mean, they'll be...
That's inside with you.
Okay. Look, let's be mature about this. It's like...
Yes.
You're going to get the...
Talk about the real mature scientific element of butt boogers.
Gentlemen, I'm afraid it's time we addressed what's been on all our minds. Okay, so, like, the food, so if I understand this right, the thinking is, the water is a big part, right? What you want is mass to stop all of that radiation from coming on in, and water does a good job because it's relatively dense. So you got all this food that has a bunch of water in it, and you set them all up as bricks all over the place. But they're going to be in, like, these little silver Mylar pouches. You grab one down, you tear it open, you
pass
eat what's
it around,
in it. Then
99 bags of poop on the wall.
Exactly. But I'm saying you don't have to look at what's in it. You know, it'll be
there.
Black bags up there
all the time. Surrounding you.
Okay, but that's already, like, my parents have a septic tank, and so they're out there lurking underneath the ground.
You're floating
is their butt boogers.
In a zero-G environment, every time you touch the wall or hit the wall,
but,
you're in a small, tiny, tiny little box. You're in a tiny little box insulated by your own feces.
Plus, if I got to assume they're like removing a butt. It's dehydrated, you know, like because like in India – They made, I assume nowadays they're a lot more modernized, but I remember learning as a kid that people in India would use manure to dehydrate and build their houses out of. So, what's wrong? Why do you hate India?
I don't know if they're going to be doing that, because that's, you know, a heat-intensive process, and there's also, it gives off chemicals, odors.
Can we talk about the smell issue? Like, I mean, like, in space, can you smell your own butt boogers? Like, I mean, if you're surrounded by butt boogers, this is going to be like an ever-continuing stink.
That's
thing?
The thing. It's like, one micrometeorite.
But this is already a problem. I mean, aren't there infections on the International Space Station? Don't they say, like it's physically, you know, like you have to brace yourself for the smell inside the ISS? And then
they're able to, every 4 or 5 months, send up new supplies and recycle stuff and filters and things like this. This is a system. This is a self-contained can that you're going to be locked inside of.
Right. Well, and plus, like, people get ill because there's all this fecal material just floating around in space. It doesn't land on the ground.
But if we're to look at it seriously, like, obviously things like this, you know, technology has a habit of not evolving at a slow, even pace. You know, it jumps and leaps forward as, you know, the right opportunities and, you know, other elements kind of come together. If we are in a more space forward kind of world where we're launching up private citizens a lot more often is it crazy to think that we are going to be trying to solve the same radiation shielding problems or that are evolving, or our thought on that won't have evolved significantly in 5 years?
We're going to have, I guess part of it is that there's always going to be a better technology.
Right.
And the question is when do
is
you
it
say
better than butt boogers?
You know, when do we say fine, but let's go do this now? Or when do we say let's wait 5 years or 10 years? And that's that question of, you know, there will always be safer ways to do things. Always do that. But then if you say we've always got to wait for the safest way, then you never do anything. And you have to say when do you say, you know, now's the time to do this? And when I read about this, I said, yeah, it's kind of cool, 500 days. But then I read, man, this doesn't sound healthy.
They're in bags, man. It's like, for somebody as, I'm really surprised, Andrew, that for somebody as Mars crazy as you, you would let butt boogers stand between you and the God of War.
I want to get their dignity. I don't want to be doing the first broadcast and freaking, like the kid from Slumdog Millionaire.
Well, I think the problem is that, like, you know, if this is your solution, and we obviously know that there are a lot of problems that go along with us, with humans living in very, very close proximity to human waste, that, like, if something goes wrong or somebody gets sick in the middle of this journey, you're kind of screwed.
All right.
Right?
I've got a question for you, too. Which is more dignity? arriving or doing a flyby of Mars in the USS Butt Boogers, or freaking the Apollo missions where people crapped in their own pants and just sat there in their own filth, and that when they splashed down after 3 days of just wallowing like a baby with diaper rash, they landed, and to where the Navy SEAL teams opening up the capsule, one of them vomits from the smell of it. Like, which one of those is more dignified?
But Brian, you're going to get that from this with 500 days.
Yeah?
Yeah, I would go with the 3 day version.
Yeah, but at least
I'll 500 take 3 days.
At least you get to wipe to in the 500 day version. You will not get diaper rash
until they realize that that some egghead underestimated the wipe quotient.
Nah, I don't know.
And you run out on day 250.
Yeah, I don't know. Man, 3 whole days of just rolling around in it.
It's going to be over in 3 days. 500. I'm saying 500.
500 days is like, look, I mean, it's like, it's no different than I don't know. I'll kick this to the listeners.
Enough for that delightful Joseph Gordon-Levitt fellow to date Zoe Deschanel.
I would rather.
Let's do a sequel of 500 Days to Mars. Go. Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Zoe Deschanel, they go to Mars and they're pooping in bags. This is
my assumption is that the bag system is not going to be perfect, and that all the problems you described with the Apollo missions are going to happen to this in the first few weeks, and then it gets worse from there.
Hmm. What other option do you think people would do? Okay, let's say magically they are able to solve the space radiation problem, right? Cosmic rays are no longer an issue. Where do you think the waste's going to go, Andrew?
I would like the same place we put it on the space station and the space shuttle, okay? And a separate system isolated from people.
Well,
there's a reason why we build toilets as far away from houses or we pump the stuff away. You know, the first ancient humans to figure this out and enjoy the health benefits were on to something.
Well, but each one will be totally sealed and encapsulated in a
butt
break.
Ziploc bag on the wall waiting for you to, hey, let's play some ball. Hit it, smack.
Well, how is that any different from micrometeorite busts through the space septic system?
But that's in a separate contained system, right?
Well, not once it blasts through, pokes a hole through it.
The amount of surface area that's now exposed by putting over the entirety of your thing, and if your septic system gets punctured, and that's on an external part of your system.
Right, but in fact, actually, I would say that you're safer with the butt bag system because each individual butt bag only has like a pound of material in it. You bust the space septic system, then you hit the jackpot of butt boogers all over the place. You can't even breathe. You die. You die suffocating in a separate system. On your own boogers.
That was designed to prefer that situation, though.
Oh, you can't just wave your hands and imagine.
No, but it is. I mean, that's a thing. I mean, well, you can design that the space septic system.
I think you guys are just being immature.
I think this is the best discussion we've ever had on the Weird Things podcast. Where is poop safest? Nay, most effective.
I could see like propaganda films that Andrew narrates, like The Brown Menace. You're keeping you from the red planets.
I'm all for Mars, but
not at the expense.
Cost is too high.
You wouldn't eat.
Listen,
I'll tell you what, this is the
very nature of adventure. That there's somebody who says butt bags in. Yeah. Totally in.
Are you kidding
I'm
me?
In on it. And that qualifies that half crazy person to be the person who is the greatest adventurer in human history.
Well, can I tell you when I heard about this? I thought one person came to mind.
Who's that?
David Blaine.
Oh, yeah, dude. He'd be all like, already did it.
Blaine right now is like, I was
actually working on
he'd
that.
He'd be like, eat all the Ziploc bag. One bag? I can do it. No, we'll give you as many. No, I think I can manage.
Dude, I would eat a butt bag of boogers in order to go to Mars. Right now. If a genie came out.
Hey, Bill Gates just sent you a box.
I was going to say, Brian, let's say theoretically there was a person in your house right now that's doing nothing but creating butt boogers.
Dude, if it was like the cost, we're like, it's 100% safe. You'll definitely come back. It'll be a crazy trip. Yeah, man. How much?
Do you realize that right now we are like a friendship with Elon Musk away from becoming like the most awesome shock jock radio bit ever? Like if Brian eats a butt booger, he gets to go to Mars.
This would be amazing.
Come back next week when we do a live remote from Stucky's bar.
I say it's time for picks.
You know what? I'll give my pick, and I'm giving this pick only based on the 10 minutes I've been able to play it. But yes. I just got home. For those of you who don't know, I spent a delightful weekend with just Robert Young, and we went and saw Brett Rouncival get married to Katie Robinson. And
willingly, too.
On purpose, in front of the whole world. I got home hours ago. First thing I did was download and install SimCity, partly because I've been excited about the game for a long time, and I played the original back on my 286 20 years ago, but also because PC Gamer is doing their, I'm going to use air quotes here for those of you guys who are audio listeners, celebrity SimCity thing. It's where it's me, it's a kicker from
Actual celebrities on there.
Yeah, yeah. One of the Minnesota Vikings, like their kickers on there. Yeah,
the punter, Chris Clue, who's a big Warcraft guy.
Yeah, Veronica Belmont, who is, of course, now the host of the Gizmodo program on BBC America.
The Gizwiz, she calls herself. She loves burritos.
Did you see that? Gary Witta, of former editor-in-chief of PC Gamer, who's the person who wrote Book Eli and this summer's upcoming blockbuster, After Earth, directed by M. Night Shyamalan. Anyway, I'm really excited. Oh, and Notch, creator of Minecraft, right? So it's like I'm all in the game where it's like I want to have a creative, crazy kind of world. And I've only made it halfway through the tutorial, and I already love it. It's already everything I liked about the original SimCity. Obviously, way more beautiful, way more fidelity and detail, and very, very simple, very intuitive so far. The only problem, of course, is everyone right now, as I look over it, glancing at the tweet deck, you can see people howling about the DRM, the fact that you have to connect to servers in order to play, even for the single-player game. Part of that is for, protecting against copyright, which is bogus. But the other part of it is that there's like you could trade from one city to another, and they have kind of global market prices that have to be configured from servers. But I love the idea. I love what they're doing. And it's good to see SimCity back. I never got into The Sims, but I'm glad to be playing SimCity.
Let me ask you just one DRM question. You know, you had a game like Spore that really kind of buckled under like the DRM controversy. Do you think
it's as bad as that experience?
No,
it's well, this is the thing, is you have to get EA's Origin, which so like literally like the most miserable downloaded game experience I've ever had in my entire life was Spore. It corrupted everything so bad with this DRM that it torched my whole computer. I lost a bunch of information. I had to scrap everything and reinstall from scratch. And as I every time I look at Spore, all I think of is the disappointment of the game and how miserable the installation was. And now in my little EA Origin thing, because I hate it right now, but is SimCity next to Spore. And so far, the launch of SimCity has been absolutely abhorrent. It's been awful.
Why does Will Wright hate you so much?
I don't know. I'm having bad luck, sir.
For a guy that talks about fun.
Yeah. You know what's fun? Restarting.
Wait, what is?
Restarting over and over. In fact, yeah. We'd like to get you 5 minutes into the game and give you the chance to remember how fun restarting is.
But you would say so far it looks like the strength of the game, that once you kind of brave this,
fingers crossed. I mean, what little I've played, I enjoyed so much that I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and say, EA, biggest video game company in the world. Maybe you would have thought they would have, you know, known how to prepare for this kind of thing. Oh, well.
But you've had good experiences. I mean, you had like Mass Effect was that's an EA title, right?
I bought that on Steam and outside of brief authentication, I don't think I had to do a thing. Knights of the Old Republic was an EA Steam release. And of course that was largely run by BioWare. But there's something about Will Wright's titles and me that just equals exploding on the launch pad. Unlike Spore, like once I got Spore working, I was disappointed at how simplistic it was. I'm hopeful that that SimCity looks like it's got a lot more depth to it, and I'll find out when I jump in.
Andrew, what's your pick?
My pick is just finished watching it last night. Now I'm watching the director and commentary.
Okay.
It's one of those movies that was just sort of a you know, I thought about this, man, I haven't seen this movie in forever. And I remember it being a lot of fun. I want to go back and I want to watch this again and see if I enjoyed it as much going through it again. And I certainly did.
Real genius.
I think I know.
No, Brian, you are wrong. Justin, perhaps you are correct. And that is Gremlins.
Hell yeah. Really? Was it that good?
Do you not like Gremlins?
Well, I never understood. Sure, I mean, outside of the dubious honor of being the title that created the PG-13 distinction, I only watched it the once when I was a kid. I haven't watched it since I'm an adult, so maybe I don't remember what's so great about it.
Gremlins, Brian. Gremlins.
That's what's great about it. There are gremlins in it. Did you miss the part with the gremlins?
So Gremlins came out in 1984. I think it was like the same week that Ghostbusters came out, actually. And the idea of the horror comedy was a very, very a kind of a recent concept. It was directed by Joe Dante, who did The Howling, which was a kind of a different kind of, you know, a mixed horror and humor at the same point, which was the idea of saying, hey, we can scare people and make them laugh. The screenplay, when I didn't know this until I just, you know, read up on this. Do you know who wrote the screenplay for Gremlins?
No. Oh, no.
The writer sent it out as he said it was a writing sample because he figured it'd be kind of hard to produce. And it was a little bit more frightening than what ended up being made. But it was Chris Columbus who went on to write, you know, some very, very beloved films and is also the director of Harry Potter and one of the EPs of that entire series. And
these are all Spielberg disciples, Chris Columbus and Joe Dante.
Yeah. They came from that. Spielberg was the one who bought the script and then had Joe Dante produce it. And they wanted to make it kind of an homage in some ways to sort of those old classic kind of films. And they shoot it, you know, the city is a universal backlot, and they didn't work too hard to disguise it because they wanted to make it feel like those kind of small town movies and then introduce the idea of these gremlins. It was fun. I had fun watching the movie. It was neat to watch it and realize this is before, you know, we had, the computerized effects, anything like that. You know, realizes, you know, it's 8 years before you're going to get a Jurassic Park, and the realization that we could just do computers. It's puppets, a lot of puppetries, and, you know, large scale models made to look smaller, et cetera. And so technically you kind of get sort of limiting, but it was just a fun movie. I certainly enjoyed watching it. And it just, you know, I certainly identified with the Gremlins more than I care to admit. And Steve Cates.
Well, and not only, but one of the most amazing WTF moments in movie history with Phoebe Cates's story about her father.
Yes. Oh, wait, like, the Santa Claus?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Like, I mean, like, it's a movie that delights in its awesome kind of tonal shifts that you don't, like, either realize are coming, but then, like, you're like, wow, this is a different movie than I thought it was. Yeah. And just when you think that you're done with these tonal shifts, there's, like, in this, like, you know, heartwarming kind of coming of age sort of story, you have one of the most morbid, weird stories that, like, has ever been put in any kind of movie with a family, you know, sort of.
Well, and keep in mind, like, it. Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you mentioned that because it sort of puts into context why they created the PG-13. They're like, okay, look, we get it. It's not R. There's no nudity. There's no cursing. There's none of that stuff. But come on, man. You tell me to bring a second grader to this thing? Are you serious?
A cool second grader.
Yeah. And Temple of Doom
were the ones that was the motivation. And Spielberg had said, yeah, we need to have this other rating because to go from PG to R
doesn't a big jump. Well, especially it was like G, like PG was just, you know, G with a little sauce on top. Like, or pretty much anything that wasn't animated would be PG. Like, because like you'd see someone, you know, either. If you saw anyone punch someone in the gut in a kid-friendly film, then, like, you were out for G because you had violence, kid-on-kid.
Oh, no, not necessarily. It depends when. Remember Star Wars, they added the shot of the arm getting cut off in the Mos Eisley cantina.
Yeah.
When Obi-Wan pulls out his lightsaber and Lucas went back, they shot that shot additionally so they could avoid a G rating because he did not want to have Star Wars be G.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, G was considered, and that was... You know, it's weird how ratings go. You have like, and you go look at, you know, like what they call pre-code films,
yeah,
which is before that, like King Kong, original King Kong, pulls a woman out of the, you know, out of her apartment, throws her onto the ground.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, bites people in half, chomps through people, you know, starts removing Fay Wray's clothes with his hands. And from long shots, she looks like she's naked. Okay. Along comes the ratings code, you know, the code, and then you don't get films like that for a long time.
Yeah. Sure.
And so they kind of, these things kind of come and they go, but you know, some of what was considered PG would be PG-13 today. And some of the things like, you know, like Star Wars would have been G if Lucas said, no, we want to get PG.
You know, it's an interesting movie. If you're into this kind of morphing of things, and it's an unfair movie and it's clearly a hit piece, but it's interesting to watch. Just, it's like having an angry roommate expound on his conspiracy theories. But this film is not yet rated. I believe should be available for instant streaming on Netflix. It's a bit of a hit piece on Jack Valenti and the MPAA. But on the flip side, as a result of watching it, you sort of understand what the stated goal of the MPAA. You know, the MPAA, Motion Picture Artists Association, is a lousy bureaucracy that was created because having a lousy bureaucracy would be better than having the government come in and tell us what, you know, who can and can't see movies.
And that's where kind of that particular documentary loses me. And when some of the interview subjects start waxing poetic about how much better it would be if we had a government board to rate movies, which I, as much as I agree with many of their cases with why the MPAA is a flawed institution, I do not agree that having the government rate things would be a better way to go about it. It's a fascinating structure, though, the MPAA. And Jack Valenti is a fascinating character that you should, if you watch that movie and you find it interesting, you owe it to yourself to read a little bit more about the MPAA.
And it's part of the birth of that was because the people who would get the blamed, you know, when you had what was, you know, people may have thought was objectionable content, were the theater owners. And the theater owners, they showed a film and then somebody went to lobby and said, you know, they said this and this is inappropriate for my kid and all this. And so theater owners were very, very sensitive about the content and wanting to be able to say, we want to be able to pass the buck off and say, you know, they said this, whatever, take it up there. And that's so much of like where there, you know, that documentary goes in about the studios, and they kind of admit the fact that the theater owners have a big control and say on that, and they're the ones selling the content and who want to, you know, meet the market demand.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I agree with your assessment entirely, Brian. It's a very fact. You got to realize it is this. It tries to say, and therefore, when you look at those other systems, though, that you have, like there's a big thing James Franco's criticizing the Australian system, which is a government one that's pretty much effectively banned a film. And we say effectively banned here, we just mean, well, you can still distribute it, show it wherever you want, but people who want to use the MPAA won't show it. But in other countries, banned means
banned. You literally, yeah. they will come and arrest you.
Yeah. As we did a while ago.
Real quick, Gremlins 2. I have a huge soft spot in my heart for Gremlins 2.
Downstairs.
What was that?
I got the disc downstairs. Came in the mail today.
All I will say is that to this day, certain friends, if you walk into the bathroom behind them, will give you a hearty, "Hey, mister, welcome to the men's room."
Man, I guess I forgot that. I know I saw Gremlins 2, but I don't remember that at all.
Gremlins 2 is a ridiculous. I mean, like, if Gremlins 1 is kind of a masterpiece.
Yo, you know what? Shifts, I might have seen Gremlins 2 in that HBO way where it's like you never, like, how many movies do you remember seeing a billion times, but then realizing I've never seen the beginning of this film because you always caught it midway on HBO.
And it is a kind of disjointed sort of just series of set pieces, you know, wrapped around this kind of like odd critique of, sequels, you know, media. Yeah, sequels and media conglomeration and Turner Broadcasting specifically and Warner Brothers.
Donald Trump.
And everything. What was that?
Yeah, and like the main villain is basically just a thinly veiled Donald Trump.
Yes, yeah, it's Donald Trump, but it's in like a CNN, you know, center kind of thing. So, but I love Gremlins too. My pick, I got two picks and an anti pick, and I'll run through them very, very quickly. Number one,
that means one pick, right? We combine.
Yes, it means eventually we will have net one pick.
Right. Well, I'm waiting for my third sub pick of subsection A in Article C of my pick list.
Quentin Tarantino wrote a script called Django Unchained. Eventually, got made into a movie, but the original first draft
of
Django is now being made into comics by, I believe, Vertigo. The art isn't fantastic, however, the script is still a Quentin Tarantino script. It's awesome. It's amazing. The first two issues are out, and then I'm going to get the rest of them as they come out on Comixology. But it's just a really awesome, interesting way to read.
Is it G or more PG rated?
No, you know, this one, it's a little more adult. And let's just say that if you enjoyed the concept of Quentin Tarantino's dialogue coming out of the mouth of reprehensible characters like Don Johnson's big daddy slave owner, there's a whole extended conversation he has with Christoph Waltz's character, King Schultz, that is like just horrifyingly awful in the most amazing Quentin Tarantino kind of way. All right. Also, something that Andrew and Brian, I believe, have recommended. I started listening to the Star Wars dramatization. I finally got into
the radio drama.
The radio drama, so great. And just if that and the Django script just kind of gives you hope that, like, you know, you can expand upon great ideas. You know, that good, well-built universes can exist. There can exist a more fuller story than you know, what we fall in love with like Star Wars: A New Hope. There's so many other awesome little elements, including backstory on Princess Leia and Bail Organa, and it's just awesome.
Scenes that were not in the movie at all, or some that were shot in a different form and got cut. You know, what I love about that radio drama is that whereas the opening of Star Wars, the first episode, episode four, whatever, is, you know, starts with that big looming shot in the action scene or whatever. Instead, the choice to start the radio drama with a very small, very private scene of Luke Skywalker privately fantasizing about joining the academy and learning how to fly. Like the story begins with him listening for the umpteenth time. You can hear him talking along with the recruitment tape as he's excited about joining the academy and join the ranks of the proud. And he's like, I love it. And it's like you get a sense of the small town that he comes from, and you feel that small townness to Luke Skywalker that is, you know, overtly stated in Star Wars, but I don't think nearly as deeply expressed as you get in the radio drama.
And you get to meet the jerk friends that he would have met at the Tashi station to pick up some power converters.
Yes. Converters. Wormy.
it's awesome. It's really, really good. My anti-pick, I really did not like Safety Not Guaranteed. And
what is that?
It's a small movie. It's got Aubrey Plaza in it. The main dude from The League, as well is kind of the co-protagonist in the story. It's about a couple magazine writers that decide to write a feature piece on a guy who's putting a want ad in the paper saying that he wants a companion to time travel with, bring your own weapons, Safety Not Guaranteed. And so they're going to go find who this guy is and what he wants. I was on the movie, and then the end is just a complete cop-out, and I didn't like it. So I'm not saying don't watch it. I'm saying that if you liked it, I'll fight you.
Amazing.
I have this animosity towards the K-Pax Martian Child sort of genre of
I never saw K-Pax. Was K-Pax just annoying?
I couldn't make it through the trailer. I don't know.
Well, really? Yeah, right. So, like, did you not like Starman?
Here's the thing that I liked about Starman, okay?
I have put a baby in you.
He starts off as Starman. Like. It's not about a movie of, like, is he? Is he really from out there? Is he? Because those are never going to be satisfying.
Well, yeah, but I mean, that's her subjective experience. It's like she spends the whole movie thinking, or the bulk of the movie thinking that he's just a crazy man who says he's from outer space. But then it's not until she, like, sees.
Yeah, but
sees
the audience, there's no ambiguity.
Right,
you
correct,
know.
Correct, correct.
And that's my point. It's like movies where, like, we're not going to tell the audience if this is real or not because there's a more important story about are people mentally ill. No, is our aliens
not
among
as interesting?
Us, yeah, is the most important part of the story.
So I guess also in that category would be a phenomenon with John Travolta, where remember he sees a flash of lights, he starts having super awesome mind abilities.
But at least you had the satisfaction of knowing something supernatural was going on.
No, but there wasn't. That was a spoiler alert. Like they find out at the
He's
end, that
having
he has a brain
stroke
tumor.
Or something.
Yeah, he
right?
has a brain tumor. That's why he got, like, super smart, because he had a lucky brain tumor, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, one of those magical lucky brain tumors.
As they are wont to do.
Yeah. So, yeah, those movies I kind of tune out on, because I'm like, no, there's a more interesting story here you're ignoring. We'll tell a quirky story. You know, is he from outer space? Is that really important?
Yes, it's pretty effing important.
Yeah, it's kind of most important thing in the history of man, you know. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've thrown out there some very provocative opinions, and we've nearly come to blows about the dynamics of interplanetary space travel and what price is too high of a price to pay. All I know, Brian, is if you go on this mission and you come back, I will salute you and I will shake your hand after you've had a very, very long Silkwood shower.
Knowing you, you'd never shake my hand again. It would always be I'd go in for the bro hug, and you'd do the, hey, man, let's do the salute. Let's do the across the room wink and nod.
Well, I'll tell you what. If you went on that trip with Bonnie, at the end of everything, if you were to rank the greatest adventures in history, you would both be number two.
It's been weird.
You want to sponsor the podcast? Do you have $30? If so, go to weirdthings.com/sponsor, and you can have Justin say whatever you want. He's a trained ape.
And now, the first two chapters of Andrew Main's new book, Night School, available now for only 99 cents on the Amazon Kindle Store, the Barnes & Noble Nook Store, or Apple's iBooks. Chapter 1, Ghosts. The helmet had a finger-long gash across the top, ending in a broken face shield. The dull gray plastic resembled a skull in the pale moonlight. The only color was a fine spray of blood that had dried on the outside. The tall man gently set it aside and aimed the narrow beam of his flashlight at the ground. The light made a cone in the cold mist. Just beyond the circle of light, things moved. He knew there were eyes out there watching. Some of them perhaps human. His companion used the edge of his shovel to knock a branch aside, sending a dry log down a small ravine. "Quiet," scolded the tall man. The shorter man tossed the shovel at the ground, took a Beretta from his waist, and pulled back the slide, making a metal click. "I thought your snitch said that the area was empty." "They did. That doesn't mean plans don't change. Put that away before you hurt someone." "That's what guns are for, not out here." "Then why are you packing a 12-gauge? "That's different, and it's not for them." The short man picked up the shovel and stabbed it into the ground. "If I have to dig much more of these, I'm going to start putting the little bastards into them." "That's not how we do things." The short man looked over his shoulder at the tall man. A layer of dirt and grime masked his face. He pointed a crusted fingernail at the shattered helmet. "These little bastards made their choice." The tall man sensed something more than greed in his companion's voice. Beneath it all was a deep-seated anger and a desire for revenge. Chapter 2. Ven. Everything goes black in the library. The boy asking the odd questions vanishes in the shadows. Red eyes appear in the darkness and stare at me. Glaring eyes, filled with rage. The first footstep is like a thunderclap as it slams the floor. The second brings the eyes half the distance toward me. Two more and it'll be upon me. I see a huge silhouette in the dark. There are horns above the eyes. Not devil horns. These are the horns of an animal. The horns of a bull. The bull man is almost on me. He grips the edge of the table and flips it into the air. Dictionaries and papers go flying. Chairs fall over, and it lands with a crack, knocking into a shelf. He's one pace away from me. His shadow falls over me like an eclipse. His shoulders lower as he prepares to run straight through me with his horns. My first day here is about to be over in less than an hour after I arrive. I knew the school was weird from the first moment I laid eyes on it. I had no idea this was only the beginning. An hour ago, I was behind a bush a block away, changing out of my tight dress slacks into a pair of my dad's old jeans. I had made a quick exit out of the apartment in the slacks so my mom wouldn't notice that they came above my ankles. There hadn't been time to take me shopping, and I didn't want to make her feel bad. She'd cried enough already. The jeans used to be Dad's. He stopped wearing them after he got sick because cinching them up with a belt made him look like a potato sack. We all joked about the farmer pants. It was the kind of laugh followed by secret sadness. When Mom sent me to the Salvation Army to drop off Dad's old things, I slipped the pants out of the box and hid them in my moving stuff. I wasn't being sentimental, just practical. Mom had more important things than taking me shopping. She just started her job at the hospital, and money was tight. I was growing out of things fast. I was terrified of showing up on my first day in high water slacks. The jeans were way too loose and out of fashion, but at least they covered my ankles. Putting them on, I accidentally brushed up against a shrub and got treated to last night's rainfall as the leaves dumped their water on my leg. It looked like I pissed myself. Fantastic. Great first day. And it was only going to get worse. 50 minutes before the bull man came charging toward me, I'm in the main office waiting for a student to show me around. Everyone ignored me. Kids walked by without a nod or a glance. The secretary didn't ask me about my name. Nobody wanted to know why I was called Marv. I was dreading having to explain it to people at the new school that it's not short for Marvin. Now that no one cared, I wanted to grab someone randomly and tell them that my dad was a big comics fan. There were no annoying jokes, only silence. Silence was killing me. Of course, I would have rejected the attention. Not having it makes me feel like a loser. When I first saw the school straddling the hill with tall redwoods looming over it, I got a chill as I noticed the morning fog clinging to the trees like a mysterious gray blanket. That was nothing like the chill I got when I stepped inside. I used to have dreams where I was invisible and nobody noticed me. I trade that for this reality in a heartbeat. As I walked up the path to the front doors, everyone seemed to look right through me. This was worse than being invisible. I was just the fog passing by. There was nothing friendly in their eye contact. It wasn't exactly hostile either. I was just a thing carried by the wind, a piece of trash blowing down the hallway. The secretary, who was uninterested in my name, handed me a schedule and told me to wait for someone to get me. I sat quietly and looked around the depressing office. It was tiny compared to my old school. The trophy case in the hallway was half empty and looked forgotten. The school was old, but not run down. The place kind of felt like something that slipped out of time. It was like an old wooden ship in a forgotten harbor where somebody cleared the barnacles and repainted every couple years, but there wasn't any love in it. I felt a sinking feeling when I realized that this was going to be my school for the next 3 years. 3 years of being a nobody. 3 years of haunting the halls like a forgotten echo. 40 minutes before the bull man came charging at me, I was contemplating my boring future when I noticed a tall shape in the doorway. This was my student guide, Carrie. Taller than my almost 6 foot frame, she was an Amazon. Dressed in old jeans and a flat green army jacket, you could almost mistake her for a man from behind. She wasn't the kind of girl who tried to act like a man. She just looked like she was trying to mask her femininity. When she handed me a photocopied map of the campus, I could see the remnants of nail polish on her fingernails. It was like she tried it on, then wiped it away out of embarrassment. Athletic, yet awkward, with her high cheekbones, she was what my mom would call a late bloomer. She could be an Olympic champion or one of those models who would have what they call an interesting look. It's the look we make fun of in high school and then slap ourselves on the forehead later because we couldn't see the real her. I thought she was kind of pretty, but I didn't make eye contact. Model, athlete, hitchhiking serial killer. As a tour guide, she sucked. Lunchroom, was all she said as she pointed through the window and the door. I leaned in to look and couldn't think of anything observational to say other than there were more of the blue plastic chairs that hurt your ass than the red plastic chairs that hurt your ass. Interesting, I mumbled. I think I got a flicker of her eyes as I made my comment. I sounded like more of a wise ass than I meant. She moved down the halls in quick strides. I had to increase my pace to keep up. Computer lab, she said in her monotone. Library? Not yet, she replied. I should have known there was something about the way she said not yet. She knew what was coming. I was too busy trying to not feel depressed by the strange way people were acting and how much smaller this school was than my old one. Smaller, yet it felt bigger, more intimidating. We walked through a courtyard. A kid with long bangs that came over his eyes lifted his head up from his calculus textbook and stared at me. I saw what might have been a slight nod, whether it was for me or Carrie, I couldn't tell. A black fabric guitar case sat at his feet, only there was something odd about it. The fabric was bent in where the bass should be. At the top, a broken zipper revealed a handle inside, wrapped in leather and ending in a pommel. When he saw me looking at the case, he slid it under the concrete bench. A raindrop landed in the middle of his equations, and he turned back to his book. Carrie was already through the doors into the next building. I hurried up to catch. Two girls, maybe 15, like me, were coming the other way. I held the door open for them, and they walked through without saying a word. A sarcastic, "You're welcome," died in my throat. Both of them were wearing jeans and shirts that looked kind of plain. I had yet to see any of the fancier brands kids wore at my old school. Kind of the stuff that you bought at the mall where the salespeople looked like models. All the shoes I'd seen were for the most part from discount store brands. After I had left my bush and headed toward the school, I noticed a neighborhood on the other facing side of the street with three-story houses. My stomach did a little panic as I realized it was a wealthy neighborhood, and here I was, walking in wearing sagging pants that were out of date even when my dad wore them. Inside the school, however, I didn't see anyone who looked like a rich kid. I thought about that as Carrie walked me down another corridor. Something hit me. "Hey, is there another high school near here?" I asked. She flung open a door. "Parker Academy is up the road." Ah, I got it. Parker Academy was the rich kids' school. There weren't any rich kids here because their parents sent them all there. I felt slightly less self-conscious about my pants. Not that it changed how people were looking past me. "Jim," said Carrie, in case the sound of bouncing balls and the smell of sweat weren't enough of a clue for me. I pretended to study the gymnasium. A group of teens playing half-court basketball stopped for a moment and then looked at me, then turned back to their game. "Do you play any sports?" I asked Carrie. She led me down the hall as she thought about the answer. "Field hockey," she finally replied. "Cool. I didn't know they had a team here." "They don't," she answered in a clipped tone, as if it were a stupid question. Pretending we were having an actual conversation, I continued, I do some martial arts." I didn't say which one, allowing her to ask me. She didn't. Instead, she replied, "I know." That was interesting. How? I deleted all my online accounts a few weeks ago. I was tired of everyone telling me how sad they were and offering their advice. I had to know. How do you know? "Then," she replied. "Ven? What is a Ven?" She stopped and faced me. "He's who told me." "Oh. Is he a teacher?" Somewhere under her high cheekbones and mouth carved from ice, she cracked a smile. "He thinks so." We walked down the hallway, and she turned to a set of double doors. "Here's Ven." It looked like a library to me, but through the small window I could see a boy about my age sitting at a table with his fingers folded, looking back at me. It wasn't the blank stare I got from everyone else. He was looking at me, almost into me, and he was smiling. It wasn't a comforting smile. It was the smile of someone who knows something, something important, something about you. I was 10 minutes from finding out what the joke was all about. I stepped inside and met Ven. That's when my life changed. That's when things got weirder. That was minutes before the bull man tried to kill me. That was the first two chapters of Andrew Main's Night School, available for only 99 cents on the Amazon Kindle store, the Barnes & Noble's Nook Store, and Apple's iBooks.